Hi, good afternoon. I'm David Murphy, editor of Mobile Marketing, and I'm talking today with Dr. David Forbes, who's CEO of Forbes Consulting. Dr. Forbes, good afternoon.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, and I hope you are too. Now, I was approached by Forbes Consulting a little while ago to talk about a product of theirs, which is called MindSight. And it seemed like quite an interesting take on market research and actually understanding people's behaviors and reasons why they take certain actions from a marketing point of view. So, Dr. Forbes, could you just explain exactly what MindSight is and how it works, please?
Absolutely. MindSight is a combination of a theory and a technology that I'll explain in a moment, but the net of it is it allows us to get responses from people that are driven directly by activity in the emotional brain, so that it allows us to tap into emotional reactions of respondents before they have any opportunity to begin to reflect on or edit those kinds of responses with conscious, rational thinking.
Can I just stop you there? Because that sounds like the Holy Grail, I'm sure, to many people listening to this. So there's a very obvious follow-up to that, which is how do you do it?
Sure enough, and I'll have to tell you that I'm an avid student of neuropsych, though I'm not myself a neuropsychologist. But in the course of my readings, one of the things that I discovered was some work done primarily in the labs of a fellow named Antonio Damasio that had to do with what happens in people's brains when you show them images. And in sum, what happens is there's a very short period of time, perhaps 100 milliseconds, in which the brain is working on recognizing the image and understanding what it's looking at. And then ensues a period of 400, 500, 600 milliseconds, in which all of the activity that's tracked on a brain scan is concentrated in what's called the limbic system. And that's an area of the brain which scientists have come to associate with emotional activity. So the wellspring of MindSight was really the notion, upon having read that material, that it would be lovely if we could develop a task in which we showed people images and then garnered their responses within that 400 to 500 millisecond time frame, in which we would be getting a response from someone based on activity that was primarily focused in the limbic or emotional portion of their brain.
So basically, they don't have time to think, what should my reaction be to this picture? It's just, this is my honest reaction to this picture.
Well, absolutely, David. And I think that historically, one of the big challenges to getting authentic emotional data from respondents is that there's a lot of things that folks simply don't want to say. One's emotional realities can cast one in potentially unfavorable lights from a rational standpoint. Our emotions can render us selfish or impulsive or any number of a host of things that are, in fact, emotional and legitimate. Everyone feels these things, but they aren't sort of for public consumption, as it were.
Okay, so I guess following on from that, then give us an example. If I was one of your subjects in one of these pieces of research, what would happen?
So, to sort of put it all together, the way that we've implemented this notion is to develop a library of validated images, and that has to do with a motivational theory that I can tell you about in a moment. But what will happen if you're in an interview is I will say, perhaps we have an interview in which I'm trying to understand why you love your profession as a video journalist. And I would give you what's called a priming sentence, which kind of focuses your mind in a certain topic area. In this case, that sentence, which would be always a dangling sentence, might be something like, I love being a video journalist because it helps me to feel more. And I would leave that blank. And my instruction to you is, David, we're going to show you a series of pictures.
Okay.
As you see these pictures, if they're each one of them will give you some sort of an emotional reaction. And when the emotion that you're feeling fills the blank for you is a kind of feeling that represents one of the reasons you love being a video journalist, then you can just strike the space key on your computer and select it.
Okay.
I would then, proceed to show you a series of, upwards of 60 images, and they would each be displayed to you for only about 800 milliseconds, and you would select as many as you like. And when I was done, I'd get to learn something about how you feel about your profession, perhaps in ways that you might not have necessarily wanted to share with me had we just been speaking together.
Okay, and I presumably then, if you sort of extrapolate that on, the question could not be what do I feel about my profession, but what do I feel about this new flavor of Coca-Cola or whatever it might be.
Absolutely,
Okay.
absolutely. Or the question might be, I wish there was a new kind of breakfast food that would help me feel more blank, at which point we'd be looking for unmet emotional needs.
Okay.
Or it could be, I choose this brand instead of others because choosing this brand helps me to feel blank, in which case we'd be looking at what we call brand affinity, which is that sort of emotional glue that sticks people to brands beyond their rational judgment of superiority. Turns out to often be more powerful than the judgment itself.
Well, let me tell you, I have no problems feeling blank. I feel blank most of the time.
I know. Well, we've done some of this research at times when people might have otherwise been at risk to tell us that they felt blank.
So is it a question then, let's say you've shown me my 60 photographs and I've ticked 12 of them. It's that combination. It's almost like an algorithm of the 12 that I've ticked.
That's right, David. What's behind the image library that we use in this exercise is a theory of motivation, which basically represents the summary of about 100 years of work in that area, and it distills it into a model which basically focuses on 9 distinct kinds of motive, and that's organized in a way which is kind of like a periodic table of emotion, frankly, that gives you a reason to sort of be able to examine the thing and conclude that it's essentially comprehensive, that those 9 will suffice to characterize the breadth of human motivation across the range of situations. And those motives aren't things that I invented. They have names like mastery and nurturance and achievement and things you would have heard about already.
Okay.
But it's the 9-ness of them which allows me to say, okay, I need photos that evoke 9 different distinct types of feeling. And that's been the basis of our standardization of the images that you might see in those 800 millisecond exposure frames.
Okay, and just give me, maybe within any one of those 9 categories, just give me an example, because I'm sure people listen to this are trying to visualize what sort of pictures they're going to see. Is it going to be skyscrapers or, little cute dogs? Well, I have no idea what I might see.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, some of the more easily conveyed, images, in the nurturance category, for example, we have a number of photos. And there, what we're looking for are photos that make one feel tender or nurturing. And so we have photos of small animals with their parents. We have mother-child photos. We have affectionate, photographs of people in love. We have a whole range of different sort of warm emotional moments. By contrast, in mastery, we have a fellow with the earth spinning on his finger. We have a picture of the cellist Yo-Yo Ma on stage all by himself with the spotlight shining down upon him. We have a series of pictures that are really telegraphing a sense of excellence and mastery at something.
Okay.
And in achievement, we have those kinds of things that you'd also think of, standing atop the mountain, being the top of the podium at the Olympic award ceremony and so forth.
So I was going to ask you what sorts of companies use this, and also, is it hard getting your foot in the door? Because, with the greatest respect to what you do, some of this neuroscience-based research can appear slightly cookie at first glance until people take the time to sort of dig a bit deeper and actually, give it a chance, as it were.
Sure. And without a doubt, I think there's a broad range of work that uses the phrase neuroscience, and I'm very careful to talk about our work as applied neuroscience in the sense that it leverages findings from neuroscience, but we're kind of the hard science without the hardware, if you will. We don't need to attach any wires to anyone's skulls or bring anyone to a laboratory or a laboratory, I suppose, as you might have it, in order to gather this data. Our clients, first of all, initial responses, frankly, to our overtures to make this available to people, we found to be quite positive. It seems that the world has awoken, and it's also, I think, there's a lot of research in the general body of psychology showing how it seems to be the case, in fact, that emotional forces may be a larger driver and a better explanation for a lot of our behavior than our rational decision algorithms. So that said, there's an awful lot of hunger out there in the marketing world as well as elsewhere for ways of understanding, measuring, and categorizing emotion. And so that said, people are on the hunt for ways to look at emotion, and MindSight in particular seems to have a lot of appeal because, number one, it has an arguable basis in real neuropsychological events that are going on. So there's an argument for the authenticity of the data that I think is important And it's distinct from some other kinds of images, you know, other image-based techniques or techniques in general, where there's a little bit of a trust me factor in some of the historical methods for studying emotion. It's also extremely scalable and can be deployed in qualitative as well as quantitative research. We just completed a study for a client that was deployed globally, including China, and did that pretty seamlessly. We had to revalidate some of our images for a Chinese audience. It turned out that basically we need Asian faces in all of our photos that had people in them. Keep that from being disruptive, because again, interestingly, I understood that after the fact, a non-Asian face is just the kind of thing that could hijack one's emotional brain, because one of the things the emotional brain is used to doing is looking at things that might be a reason for alarm. And a face that looks unfamiliar might, in fact, be just such a reason. So your ability to appreciate the rest of the emotionality of the photo could be essentially interrupted. So that's why we had to make those changes to validate that. But those are all reasons, you know, the international deployability, the ability to use this in qualitative as well as quantitative. I think the argument for its for the authenticity of the data that seems to be fairly well founded, and the general interest now in the marketplace for insights about emotionality that has grown pretty significantly, have put us in pretty good stead. And we're working quite extensively in the pharmaceutical industry, where a big challenge is talking to docs, because doctors very much want to present themselves to the world as scientific algorithm machines, and yet at the same time, the way that they feel about their experience of treating patients is a part of the medical reality and something that folks that want to serve the doctor's interests need to be able to hear about. We've done quite a bit of work in what I call brand affinity, and a lot of that's in consumer packaged goods as well, where what you're trying to do is essentially understand that emotional stickiness that makes one loyal to a brand beyond sort of irrational reasons one might give for such a loyalty pattern.
Okay. So it sounds like we're talking, you know, fairly large companies who have maybe exhausted traditional ways of doing research and are always looking for, you know, the bleeding edge, the next big thing, really.
No, that's well put, David. Our clients are pretty much Fortune 500 under Fortune 100 companies, and indeed, you know, we're not the first thing they've ever done by way of the search for emotion, but they continue to look because they've not been satisfied. And many of them have, in fact, explored more mainstream traditional neuroscience, wherein one, you know, hooks people up and uses hardware.
Okay, and obviously I know a lot of the work you do will be commercially sensitive, but I wondered if there is one example you might be able to give us, perhaps without naming a client, where your technique has been used to actually completely, you know, disprove what they thought to be the case about their customers, or just something that would demonstrate the effectiveness of MindSight in terms of changing perceptions.
Absolutely. I'll give you a couple examples, and in both these cases, I will need to be somewhat elliptical because, and perhaps in this work more than others, even clients seem to be especially sensitive because they feel like they're gaining some sort of, you know, powerful insights into how people them to themselves. We did a piece of work recently for probably the largest manufacturer of home care and personal care products in the U.S. For a shampoo brand, and in this particular case, a major part of the marketing toolkit, if you will, for the brand are headshots of women with, you know, beautiful hair, and obviously the choice of that headshot is very mission critical because different women with different hairdos and different looks can convey a whole lot of different ranges of attitude, if you will. So that's a picture that's clearly worth at least 1,000 words and maybe several. So they had a series of pictures that they had, through traditional means, winnowed their interest down to, it was about 5, but they weren't really being able to get it much further than that. And they were going to be in the place where I guess they'd historically been, where they just needed to kind of then by consensus and committee say, okay, we'll take number 4. So they came to us to see if we could sort that out for them. And indeed what happened when we used MindSight, and there the MindSight stimulus sentence that we used was, you know, if I had hair like this woman, I might feel more. And we then looked at what's the emotional benefit promise that's inherent in this image of the woman that would go along with the shampoo brand. And we discovered a very interesting thing, which was there were two of the five images which had distinctly more compelling emotional promises than the other three. But at the same time, the nature of the emotional promise in terms of what sort of an image one might project or how one might then be able to feel about oneself having used the product were very distinctive and in fact represented what I think is sort of a schism in modern femininity between the sort of historical, kind, gentle, caring, image of femininity, historical, and the new empowered, competent, achieved image of modern femininity. Mm-hmm. So it was quite interesting. I think it helped them a lot in terms of, you know, making a choice that they were otherwise having a rough time taking, and also gave them, I think, some insight that they hadn't had as strongly in the past about options they had for how to appeal to.
Sure. And just going back on that example, because I just want to make sure that everyone fully follows this. When you talked about leaving this sort of sentence dangling, if I had hair like this, I might feel more. And the process is, you know, ticking on these boxes. But are you leaving, is it a question of depending on the combination of boxes they tick, that's going to tell you what that blank word is? Or in addition to, right, okay.
That's absolutely right. The blank is the spot in which they're then completing the sentence by picking pictures.
Right, okay.
So I might feel like the feeling that picture gives me, or I might feel like the feeling that picture gives me. And typically, you know, a respondent might pick, you know, 8, 12, up to 20 of these 60 pictures.
Right, okay.
What we'll get then is a profile across these 9 types of motivation. And just as a kind of a top-line example, those two cases I was mentioning, in one case what we saw was quite a large spike in terms of an emotional promise of nurturance and connectedness and those social emotional energies, whereas in the other case we saw a spike in terms of an empowerment and achievement and mastery and that sort of more.
I'm with you. And the brand will be looking perhaps exactly for one and exactly not for the other. Therefore, you know, it's option two instead of option four, as it were.
That's correct.
Okay. And then obviously this is all fascinating stuff, and we are Mobile Marketing Magazine, and I can imagine some people listening to this thinking, well, yeah, that's great, we do like an insight into the bigger picture, but what I would really like is for you to tell me that there is a mobile element to this. So is there?
Yes, there is indeed, and part of the reason for us going into that space, because I might just sort of happily report that we're pretty busy with our non-mobile version. There seems to be quite a lot of demand, and we're having some quite interesting successes there. But insofar as you've gotten a tool that allows you to measure motion, then it becomes a very compelling next step to try to measure motion in the moment.
Sure.
And, you know, it took us a bit for my IT folks to, you know, implement this image. Part of the deal is, of course, you've got a very precise timing of the presentation of the images, and you need to get this to work on a mobile platform. Mm. So you need to get it to work across a range of platforms that, you know, map and correspond to the range of IT that you encounter when you're trying to get people on their mobile device. It's not all the same. In any case, we did that indeed, and we've done a couple of studies that I think are pretty interesting. One was a study that we did wherein we intercepted folks right as they were leaving a large mall having done clothing shopping.
Okay.
And the intent there was to try to understand what the shopping experience was like and what were the highlights emotionally and what, if any, were the low points. And what we found, and so people were basically given a small card and said, gee, if you'd like to tell us about your experience, you can, you know, go to this website on your phone in the next half an hour and take a little interview, and then we'll compensate you with an electronic coupon.
Okay.
And we discovered some pretty interesting stuff there. We discovered, interestingly, that one of the emotional negatives that pervaded even amongst folks who then in follow-up standard survey questions said that they shop fairly frequently or that they claim to like shopping is that a lot of pieces of the process, at least, were boring. That there was a certain routine quality to how one moves through retail spaces and approaches shelves, and that it can become kind of routinized onto being stultifying. And one of the things that we took up with clients in this case was the notion of the sort of shoppertainment, as it were, you know, that there might be room in retail settings for even something as explicit as a roving magician.
Yeah, a bit of theater, in-store theater.
Yeah.
Literally, yeah, okay.
And so that was interesting. Another study we did for a large purveyor of coffee. And we chose to take that time, which we figured might be most problematic, frankly, and therefore a good illustration of how appealing the mindset is, which was morning coffee. Wherein you're lucky, were we to try to do a traditional piece of interviewing, I think we'd have been lucky if one person in 100 wanted to stop and give us 20 words, because people are on their way to work.
Yeah.
They haven't yet had the coffee that they purchased, and they're not, shall we say, with their game face on yet.
Yeah, sure.
And this particular client had a large number of stores. This was a franchisee for this particular coffee brand, and had a large number of stores, a couple of whom were sort of mysteriously performing one about twice as well as the other, despite demographics and sort of placement that would have suggested there was no need for that. And so we went in search of the emotional experience of that visit to the coffee store. And the thing that we found, which, again, I think very much consorts with some things I'll tell you about how we've learned what people feel like in the morning, but in the one, both stores felt the experience on the positive was efficient. They fed us back a sense of achievement. They fed us back a sense of empowerment, which is, of course, sort of the boost, if you will, of getting the coffee and getting ready to go and so on. And so that really didn't differentiate. But one store, there was a very strong sense of nurturance, which in a fairly, you know, functional interchange of please, here's my coffee, could have been maybe somewhat surprising. But we've done a lot of work in the breakfast space, and we've done some of that, in fact, for breakfast cereal manufacturers and folks like that. And one of the things I think I've learned over the years is that it's as if each morning, each of us in our own minds is kind of born anew. You're sort of your own infant, and you want to be quiet so you don't wake the baby, so to speak.
Sure.
And I think in that context of wanting gentle noises and foods that aren't too terribly disturbingly crunchy or spicy or otherwise disruptive to the peace, if you will, that having someone use your name as they present your coffee or know what you want when you enter the door before you get to the front is sort of consistent with that sort of emotional desire for caretaking.
Yeah, yeah.
That comes from this sort of self as infant kind of metaphor we may all carry around.
Okay.
At the end of that, interestingly, we realized as I was presenting this at a conference, and someone said, "So, gee, what does that say about the fact that at Starbucks they consistently, routinely put your name on the cup and call you out by name?" And in the course of that discussion, we realized that that was probably another way in which that chain is, you know, kind of ahead of the curve in terms of being clever.
Yeah, sure. Okay. And with the shopping mall experience, you talked about sort of recruiting people on the hoof, as it were, you know, just by handing out these cards. Is that how it tends to work on the mobile platform?
Well, you know, going forward, I expect that we'll begin to be able to do this. You know, we're talking with a fast food chain where turns out that the vast majority of business now in quick service restaurants, as they call themselves, fast food to the public, is drive-through, at least in the U.S. And it's very difficult, of course, to talk to those people at all about anything because, you know, you're looking up the tailpipe of their car as they retreat onto the street.
Sure.
And the notion is that you could then potentially, on the receipt or with some other kind of incentive that's handed out to them by the cashier as they get their food, invite and incent them to participate in talking about the experience that they've just had driving through and getting their food. And you know, it's our position, and I think our clients share that understanding that experience and thinking of it essentially as the store visit at this point is mission critical to brand development.
So perhaps something as simple as a QR code on the receipt that they scan,
exactly,
taken through. Good
exactly.
Stuff. Well, Dr. Fultz, it's been absolutely fascinating. I wish you the best of luck with it. Anybody who wants to know more about Mindsight can go to forbesconsulting.com and find out everything they need to know there. Thank you very much indeed.
Fabulous, David. My pleasure.